This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Time to play with pain. Hosted by Emmy-winning comedian and writer Jeff Cesario. Interviewing guests from comedy, entertainment, and sports. Plus, legendary sportscaster Chet Waterhouse. Don't worry, this shouldn't take longer than your average trip to Costco. And now, here's your host, Jeff Cesario.
Welcome to the podcast, Play With Pain. My guest today, you know how when you watch a talk show and then they have like the writers act in the sketches, and a lot of times you go, oh, that's a writer. But then a lot of times you go, holy crap, that guy was funny. This is a guy who is funny and does both. Killer writer, killer performer. You'll recognize him from sketches on Conan, like the 1940s racist ghost crooner, or my favorite, the inappropriate heavy metal guitarist. I think that was you. That was my favorite. Brian Stack is here. Brian, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks. Great to talk to you, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, you look, I see the capital of Wisconsin blaring in from right behind you. Straight up, that's the shot up State Street right to the Capitol. That's beautiful.
It is, yeah. I really love Madison. I went there for grad school. I know you went there for undergrad, and I only spent 2 years there, but I feel like I spent like 10 years because it's where I started.
Most people do.
Yeah, it's where I started. I can see why people want to live there too. It's where I started performing improv and stuff too. So it's always been, I'll always have a soft spot for Madison. I always love to get back.
Oh, cool. It's where most people started smoking dope is in Madison. Yep. And that can often go hand in hand with improv. Before I get rolling too much, Chet, do you have an update for us? I have a luxury edition with a leather interior update. Time for the Waterhouse update, sponsored by Blah Blah Blah, the app that listens to the boring part of conversations for you. America's pastime. No, not getting stupid rich and buying a British soccer team. Baseball. Suspended Padre Fernando Tatis Jr. meeting with teammates to apologize. Apologize. Kicked it off with a mellow bowl of indica. Yankees falling apart like a knockoff Prada bag during a TSA inspection. Houston on a tear, said slugger Jose Altuve. They haven't caught us cheating yet. I mean, we're not cheating this year. And the Dodgers, like the FBI going after that weird box in Trump's golf locker. They just keep coming at you. That wrap-up sponsored by Rev Stiff, the car muffler that makes your wiener feel bigger. NFL! Aaron Rodgers' receivers are so young, Dane Cook thinks they're hot. Carolina names Baker Mayfield their starter. And Progressive Insurance breathes a huge sigh of relief. The Giants are the New York team in that they smell like urine. Browns' Deshaun Watson suspended 11 games. That breaks down to about 27 minutes. Her allegation. That item sponsored by Observesa, the beer that's good for your eyes. Golf! LIV Tour officials insisted they are not taking Saudi blood money. They held a press conference at this week's tour stop, the Stalin Invitational. NBA! Kevin Durant will stay with the Brooklyn Nets! So that whole thing was more useless drama than daytime television. And finally, oh, this week in sports history, Brian, the year 1934, the place Boston, Massachusetts, in one of the most amazing feats in baseball history. Red Sox pitcher Wes Farrell not only hurls 12 innings, but also hits two home runs to beat the White Sox 3-2. Netflix has announced a biopic. In keeping with their casting guidelines, Farrell will be played by Ken Jeong. This Waterhouse update sponsored by Dick Tucker's Women's Clothes for men. Back to you, Jeff and Brian. Wow, thank you, Chet. That was quite a roll through the today's sports headlines.
Yes, thank you, Chet. That was very informative.
Oh, you're welcome, Brian. Anytime you need me, just call. I'll pop in every now and then with a, hey, that compliment was sponsored by the Dollar Confederate Statue Store. Back to you guys.
Sorry about my dog barking, too.
Oh, that was, no, listen, Chet's had to deal with a lot worse than that.
He gets very scared of anyone coming near the house and starts going at it there.
So you're actually in your house, because at first I thought you're straight up day drinking at a pub.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I am in my house.
If he wants to jump on the sofa with you, go ahead, let him. I'd love to. What's his name?
Banjo, come on over here.
Banjo.
Oh, he's scared. Now he's scared. He's running away. He's scared.
That's the way to get him out of the room. Threaten airtime.
Exactly. Well, thanks for your patience.
So now you're back out. You're writing currently on the Late Show with Stephen Colbert, correct?
That's right. Yeah, I was at Conan for 18 years, which is hard to believe. It's crazy when I think about it that way. I was actually supposed to be there, come in for 13 weeks to fill in for a writer who was out after with a broken leg, and it turned into 18 years, which is really crazy. But
how'd you get the tip to write for it? Or was it just a blind submission? Or did someone on staff go, Brian, you should go for this 13 week gig that turned into 18 years?
It was kind of a combination. Like some of the guys knew me from Chicago, like Andy Richter and Tommy Blacha, who was the guy who broke his leg, and Greg Cohen and Brian McCann, who were all working there. And when they knew someone, they wanted someone to come in temporarily, they said, hey, Brian, would you send in a packet to be considered? And it was really nice of them to recommend me, because Conan and John Groff, the head writer, did not know me at all. And then luckily they liked the stuff I was doing during that 13 weeks, and it turned into 18 years, which is really crazy when I think about it. But
do you remember anything from that packet?
Oh, you know, it's weird because I'm trying to think. I had one idea that I think Poseidon, the god of the sea, was being wheeled out in a tank and humiliated, being forced to read promotional stuff, and like, and it was too impractical. Like, it would have required a big tank and everything. But I think one thing I learned from talking to them later on was that they liked when they would look at packets. They didn't worry so much about whether they could do ideas. They just like to see how people think and what they think is funny.
Right.
Like Greg Cohen, who got hired there too, said he had a bunch of ideas where Conan looked at it and he said, well, we can't do any of this stuff, but it's funny.
Right. Oh, and, that's great.
Yeah.
So then after 13 weeks, who comes and breaks it to you that you're staying?
Oh, it meant a lot. They were saying they weren't sure they'd be able to hang on to me, because NBC would have required them to sign off on having another writer, even when Tommy came back after breaking his leg. Luckily at the time, NBC was, I think, at the height of their success with, like, they had Friends and Seinfeld and Law and Order. So I probably felt like a drop in the bucket making Writers Guild Minimum, you know, like I was like bagel money. So
right. And folks, for those of you who may need a memory jog, Tommy Blacha was the wiener character. What was the name of the wiener character?
Yeah, the gaseous wiener.
Gaseous wiener. And then McCann was he was always getting shot in the side. What was that thing where he was constantly getting shot?
I remember I shot him in the bulletproof legs bit.
Bulletproof legs. He had bulletproof legs. That was it.
Yeah, Brian did tons of bits, but that one was a classic example of how a lot of our favorite stuff came up completely by accident. Cause in the writer's meeting one night, we were waiting for a meeting to start. It was probably like 11 PM. And I was pretending to shoot Brian in the leg when he was sitting next to me. And he started singing that he had bulletproof legs. So I shot him in the chest and he fell off the chair dead. And we're like, we could do that tomorrow. Right. Like,
and nothing.
It wasn't something either of us would have thought of on our own, you know. It was just, right. I think around the right people, as you know, if you're around the right people and you're just screwing around, I'm sure a lot of your favorite bits have come up just from screwing around and like having the same sensibilities of people around you, you know?
Sure. That's why you build a room on the premise of, is someone funny? Not are they producing funny stuff in a packet that can be used necessarily tomorrow, but do they just think funny? Are they going to fit into this crazy room of writers? So improv comes directly in play here. It comes in handy in a direct way. Improv is sort of elusive for a lot of people to kind of nail down. And it always looks like one of those things. It's like soccer to me. It looks like it's more fun to play than it is to watch. And a lot of times that's true with improv. But sure, you learned a crazy amount of muscles in Chicago, correct? This was the place where you started in Madison, you said.
Yeah, I did my first performing. I took a beginner class in Chicago when I finished college at Indiana University. And then the summer after I finished college, Mick Napier, who became a big legendary director at Second City and founded the Annoyance Theater in Chicago, he told me about Improv Olympic in Chicago, which is now later called I.O. And I took a beginner class there. And then I went off to Madison for grad school. And by sheer luck, there was this wonderful little improv theater there, the Arc Theater, where one of the guys in my first group in Madison was actually the late, great Chris Farley.
And, wow.
So it was such a treat to see him, even in those early days, how brilliant he was and what a naturally gifted comedian he was, and the effect he would have on regular people, even in bars. You know, you go out in Madison and he would have that same effect that he later had on everyone, on regular people. And you could see people's eyes would just light up around him and everyone could tell he was special, you know. And then I went off to Chicago after a couple years in Madison, which is my hometown anyway, and started doing improv there at I.O. and took class at Second City and later worked at Second City before going to Conan. So I worked as I got hired at Second City and worked there for 4 years professionally before going to Conan in 97.
So this has really, first of all, before I forget, what were you majoring in? What did you go to grad school for? That has clearly just been collecting dust, probably on a bookshelf that's about 3 feet to your left right now.
It really had, like, I actually apologized to the chair of the department a few years back. I went back to Madison to do a Q&A for students and stuff. And she was so sweet about it. But I said, I apologize. I was always so distracted by the comedy stuff that I kind of went to grad school for all the wrong reasons. It was communication arts in Vilas Hall there.
Sure, Vilas Hall. That was my stomping grounds.
Yeah, and I really loved my 2 years in Madison, and I loved the people I met there in the grad school and in the improv scene. But I was definitely, once I got into the improv stuff, that was probably where most of my focus was, I think, 95% of it. And but it was comm arts, and then when I went off to Chicago, my day job was in advertising for a few years when I was just doing improv for fun and for free. You know, there was no money in it until I worked at Second City. And then there was not much money, but we could get by.
Did the day job motivate you to quit it? Or you know what I mean? Was it like, this is rubbing me the wrong way and improv is working at night, I got to figure out a way to monetize improv? Was it motivational on any level?
Well, to tell you the truth, working in advertising gave me a real appreciation for people who are really good at that and how hard it is to do that well, because it requires your ability to, you have to get in all the stuff the client wants and also try to make it entertaining. That's like when I see a good ad to this day, I'm like, wow, they jumped through a lot of hoops to make this happen. Like if I see a good ad, like a Geico ad or something, you know, it's funny that a lot of the funniest ads are for insurance, the most unfunny thing in the world, but it developed an appreciation for it. But I always knew that if I could ever get hired at Second City, I would drop anything to do that. Like, and even though I liked the people I was working with in advertising, my dream was to get work Second City. And I didn't really think beyond that at the time. I wasn't thinking about working in television or anything like that. I just desperately wanted to work at Second City. And
why?
I think because so many of my heroes had come through there, and because when I would go there, it just felt like, as corny as it sounds, I felt like almost like a a monk wandering in from the desert into a huge, you know, cathedral or something. Like, it felt like, you know, that feeling probably with you when you walk into those stand-up clubs where you're like, I'd love to perform here someday. All my heroes have performed.
Yeah, I do remember distinctly, I've talked about it before, Gary, my producer will vouch for it, that one of probably the biggest trigger moment for me was being in a club in Minneapolis watching stand-up. And I had like a panic attack. I said, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be up there. Oh, and I had to leave. I literally had to leave. I couldn't take it anymore. So I'm guessing there was some similar drive in you that said, even if it's subconsciously, I have the skill set. It seems like I have an affinity for this. I got to dive in.
Yeah, I know that's such an amazing story that you told about that feeling. Cause I remember having that feeling of, I remember feeling I would love to do that. That looks so fun. Before I actually tried it, I remember seeing it and thinking that looks so fun. I'm too scared to try it because I'm too scared to find out I'm not good at something I love so much. And right. When I finally tried it in that beginner class at IO, I instantly was mad that I hadn't tried it sooner because right. I loved it instantly. But yeah. I didn't have the confidence at first to think I loved it, but I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be any good at this. And when it turned out to be something that I was suited for, it was a huge relief. And but it made it more fun. And because I'd had things like growing up where I wanted to be a great athlete and I'm slow and clumsy. And I just, you know, I dreamed of being like winning Wimbledon and all this stuff. And
incidentally, guys, those are a couple of bad hurdles if you want to be an athlete. That's sponsored by Nugentix. Winter pills directly from Ted Nugent. Those companies just mails them right to you. Okay, go ahead. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Ted Nugent, by the way, most famous guy to go to my high school.
Wow. What's your high school?
It was St. Viator High School. It was an all-guys high school in and it was funny when I was growing up.
Wow, that's a third-tier saint there.
Yes,
saint
exactly.
Viator.
Yeah, I don't even remember anything about him, but I do remember everybody
patron
at the time.
Patron saint of energy drinks? I don't know. I can't Viator.
Sounds very plausible. It was funny because when I was in high school, Ted Nugent was at the height of his fame, too. Like, you know, I graduated in 82, and like, everybody thought it was really cool that Ted Nugent had gone there years before. Sure. And now I'm kind of like, oh, Ted Nugent, geez, what are you saying now? But
right now they're ripping down Ted Nugent Avenue from the playground, and those signs are all gone.
Exactly. Back then, I didn't know anything about his politics. Everybody just knew he was a big rock star. You know, he was like,
yeah. So things start unfolding for you. You're doing improv in Chicago. You started in Madison with the likes of Chris Farley. You moved to Chicago. You've got some pretty strong playground mates at your improv experience in Chicago at Second City as well. You've worked with some. I think you worked. Were you there when Colbert was there?
He was a little bit. It was funny because the first time I ever saw Stephen perform, I was going to see Farley's first touring company show when he got hired in the Second City touring company. And I was so excited for Chris, and I went to go see his first show. And in that cast was Stephen and wow. And Paul Dinello, who works with me now too at our show. And Ian Gomez was in that, who's been in tons of stuff, and Rose Abdu, who's been in tons of stuff, and Jenna Jolovitz. And there was just a great group. But I later, when I got into touring company, Stephen was in the main stage cast with Steve Carell and Amy Sedaris. And but I came up when I was touring. I got to tour. My wife Miriam was in my touring company, who was a blast to tour with. And Adam McKay, you know, who's now a big director. And Amy Poehler.
Tremendous writer and performer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Adam's Adam's one of the most brilliant, naturally funny people I've ever met. And Dave Koechner came up with us, and Rachel Dratch, and Pat Finn, and
wow,
Susie Nakamura. And then you got like Tina Fey and Amy Poehler came in. They started touring as we were starting to get into the resident companies, but they did some shows with us too. And there was just so many wonderful people. Neil Flynn was in our cast, and you know, who was
that's impressive. So the touring company sounds like I had a mildly parallel experience in Minneapolis with the Dudley Riggs Touring Company and the Dudley Riggs Main Stage Company. The touring company goes out at mostly regionally and tours with the show and with a giant chunk of actual improv and plays colleges or community theaters or things like that usually. Is that correct? The same for Second
City? A lot of community theaters. We play a lot of colleges. Like we got to go back and do a show at University of Wisconsin. I won at Indiana University too. So it was going back to the old schools. That was especially fun. But it was, we did a lot of colleges, a lot of little small towns, and it would really vary. Like we would do some shows where there'd be, you know, 1500 people, full house. And then you'd go to another show. Like we did one at a place called Husson College in Maine. And we said, where are we performing? And they said, it's in here. And it was this little classroom. And we said, where are the lights? And the guy flips the light switch on the wall. And we're like, do people know we're coming? And they said, we put up a flyer. And so
that's great. That is so great.
We had to go over to the dorm and say, anybody want to see a show? Oh, I think six guys came over. And so it was a real spectrum of.
So there are nights when you feel like, man, I am in show business.
Right.
And then the very next night you realize show business is so fragile. You go to a place that doesn't even have a lighting or a sound focus. They don't even have, banana pallets on the floor for a stage. And you realize, oh, this whole thing can unravel in a heartbeat.
Yeah, you're always like one hair away from Puppet Show and Spinal Tap. You know, it's just always like, you're always like, but then you do a show that would just, we'd go to a show at like in Colorado in a little ski town where you're not expecting anything and have just the best crowd you've ever had, like a little ski town theater. And so you never knew what it was going to be, but touring was so fun because most of the time, as you know, if you're touring as a stand-up or like the only touring I did was for a couple years with this group, but 95% of the time you're not on stage. So you're just riding in vans, and Adam, you know, guys like McKay would just be doing bits constantly. And it was so entertaining, you know, to just sit back and watch them go. Like he would do, I shared an apartment with my now wife, Miriam, in Dallas when we did a month of shows there. And it was just nonstop bits. And as you know, that's most of the fun when you're touring, because otherwise you'd go nuts if you, if it was just, because it's so much more than the shows, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That life is not only inspirational on a level, this is kind of what I've always wanted to do. This is the dues paying period of what I've always wanted to do, but also it's just, there's a foxhole camaraderie there. Nobody else is living through this. We're not only living through it, we're making hay off it. We're being funny because we have to survive, you know, the truck stop in Denton, Texas, when the van broke down, or the 6-person show in, you know, some obscure place in Maine or wherever. It's so much fun that, and you know, you're going to look back, even when you're living it, I believe, you know, you're going to look back on it and go, man, that was fantastic.
Absolutely. That's so well said, Jeff, because it's like, and it's why I think you form such incredibly close friendships and with these people that last the rest of your life, because you are in the trenches with these people depending on each other. And as corny as that sounds, like it is like foxhole mentality. Totally.
Yeah. And you know, to borrow the phrase, people who then make it to any level, let alone make it big, trust that first group of friends because they know, oh, they took a shell to the chest for me one night, in Ely, Oklahoma. You know, I know if I turn and I'm in a blinding blizzard of panic, that person's going to be there with me. And that is the kind of, I guess you'd call it networking now, that's just priceless in show business.
It is. And it really, that's so true. And like, I can't tell you, like I mentioned, like I got the opportunity to submit for Conan from people who knew me from Chicago. And what it is most of the time, and I often think about like Colbert recommended Carell for The Daily Show. you know, Adam McKay hired Tina Fey to write at SNL.
Wow.
Tina reached back and said, Jack McBrayer, I want to put him in 30 Rock. And it's people who know your work from another place recommending you to people who don't know your work, that just don't know you're good. And but you do reach back for the people you trust that you came up with in those trenches, because, you know, as you said, they take a shell for you, and you know who you can count on, and you know who you trust and who you think is funny. And
yeah, and it's based on that. It's based on that. It's based on who you know is funny, and who you know is funny in virtually the worst possible environments.
That's perfectly put. Yeah, that's it. If you can laugh off a really bad show in Lima, Ohio, you know, yeah, where, you know, and I just remember we did some shows in Lima, and actually I think they were pretty fun. But I just remember there was like there were some along the way, though, where so much of our bonding would come through shared misery over, like, we did a show in Vegas that was almost completely silent from the audience. And we were laughing so hard because we knew it wasn't our fault. Because, like, sometimes it is. Sometimes you're just off. You know,
that's like doing Sunday Mass in the infield of a NASCAR race. It's just the wrong venue, improv in Vegas. It's just wrong.
It is. The guy came up to us, I swear, right after the show, and he goes, sorry, guys, I guess they wanted booze and strippers. And we're like, oh, I guess so.
And yeah, we knew that 30 seconds in.
Yeah, exactly. I actually burst out laughing on stage during that show, because there was a line, an old Colbert line from a scene we were doing as a touring company, and it killed everywhere. It killed with old people, young people, college students, you know, conservatives, liberals. It always killed. And I said it, and it got nothing. And I just started laughing on stage because we were so screwed that it's just funny.
Yeah. So screwed. Babe Ruth with his big bat struck out. Nothing happened that night.
Yeah. And there are other times where it's, you feel like you're just off, or the group's off, and we're just having a bad night. But there are other nights where you can kind of just, Stephen said that Colbert said that one of the directors at Second City told him, you have to learn to love the bomb. You know, you have to learn to love it, because it's going to happen, and you have to kind of enjoy it, because, and it hurts when you think you're just off and you're just not delivering. But there are other times where the circumstances are so out of your
absurd
control.
Yeah, they're just so absurd.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I remember walking into a stand-up gig once down a hallway. It was a rock and roll and strip club in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And it was like a NASA entrance ramp or something. It seemed like 100 yards long just to enter the front door and until you got to the club. And there's like, and all I see, it's like a blue liquor Monday nights, slippery nipple night Tuesday. It was just shots and booze advertising all the way into the thing. And I thought, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. And it was a great gig. It was a great gig. They just came ready. I got them early. I got them 7 at night before they got too liquored up. But it was still, you just never know on the road. And when you're working with others on the road, I can imagine that just becomes a bond you just never, ever forget.
It really does. And I'm sure you've had the same thing. And I got to say, Jeff, I have the highest admiration for guys like you who've done stand-up, which I've never done. Because the idea of going on stage by yourself when you don't know what's coming sounds so much more terrifying than, like, I go up there and I'm going up there with a platoon, you know?
Right.
Like, you're like Audie Murphy out there taking the machine gun nest right, by yourself.
Yeah. But the flip side of that, honestly, is because of that, a stand-up can't really professionally get comfortable with the bomb, or he's just never working.
Oh,
so, yeah. So I never got comfortable. There are guys who are. I just never got comfortable with it. I had a fifth gear. I could jam it in and do material that I knew would, you know, play to the lowest common denominator, because I wanted to generally come back for a paycheck in 9 to 12 months at the same room. So, you know, so, yeah, and I think that is a downside. And then the other downside people, I don't think, understand about acting or sketch is you're making somebody else's words funny. That terrifies the shit out of me. I know I can make my words funny because I've worked them and I've tried them and whatnot. But when somebody hands you something, and I mean, I've read stuff and gone, this just isn't funny to me. And I'll hear somebody else do it and they make it funny. That is a skill that I don't know how you get that. I don't know. You have to have something in you that goes, okay, let me manipulate this dialogue a different way without changing the words. I don't know how you do it.
It is an interesting, there is an interesting difference there. That's a good point. Cause, and I know, like, not having been a trained actor, like I came out of improv, just pure improv originally, I've always developed, a lot of respect for people that have that kind of acting technique to fall back on. Like Neil Flynn was one of the guys I asked once when we were working at Second City. I said, hey, Neil, you know, all that training you've done, like he did shows at Steppenwolf and Goodman and did a lot of dramatic plays. And I said, is there stuff you've gotten from that you didn't get from improv? And he said, it helps on the nights when I'm not into it. I remember thinking, so he had a technique like you just described your ability to shift into that gear,
right?
Where you can still deliver the goods, even if you're not feeling it or inspired.
Even if all you're thinking about is getting back to the Budgetel and watching SportsCenter. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that Neil was saying something similar there, where his acting technique allowed him to kind of push through and deliver even when his heart wasn't in it. And I remember thinking, that's a really good thing to be able to fall back on, you know?